Part 7. Matthew Rose Sorensen. Valentine Ketterly has disappeared. Entry for the 26th of November, 2018. Valentine Ketterly, psychologist and anthropologist, has disappeared. The police have made inquiries and discovered that before his disappearance, he made some unusual purchases. A gun, an inflatable kayak, and a life jacket. Purchases that his friends all agree were completely out of character. He had never shown any inclination to be waterborne before. None of these items has been found in his house or office. The police think that possibly he used the inflatable kayak to travel to a remote spot and then used the gun to kill himself. But there is one officer, a man called Jamie Askill, who has a different idea. He believes that the sudden and unexpected disappearance of Dr. Ketterly must be linked in some way to the sudden and unexpected reappearance of Matthew Rose Sorensen. Askill's theory is that Ketterly imprisoned Rose Sorensen somewhere, in the same way that Ketterly's one-time supervisor and tutor, Lawrence Arne Sales, imprisoned James Ritter years before. Ketterly's motive, thinks Askill, was the same as Arne Sales's: to manufacture evidence of Arne Sales's theory of other worlds. Ketterly became alarmed when the police uncovered the link between himself and Rose Sorensen. Faced with the exposure of his crimes, Ketterly let Rose Sorensen go and then killed himself. Askill's theory has the advantage of accounting for the reappearance of Matthew Rose Sorensen at the same time, give or take a day or two, that Ketterly disappeared, which is otherwise an odd coincidence. Where the theory falls down is that neither Arne Sales nor Ketterly ever used the disappearances as evidence of anything. In fact, for many years, Ketterly had been loud in his denunciation of Arne Sales. Undeterred, Askill has questioned me twice. He is a young man with a pleasant, good-natured face, little brown curls all over his head, and an intelligent expression. He wears a dark blue suit and a grey shirt, and speaks with a Yorkshire accent.
"Did you know Valentine Ketterly?"
he asks. "Yes," I say. "I visited him in mid-November 2012. He looks pleased with this answer.
"That's just before you disappeared,"
he points out. "Yes," I say.
"And where were you,"
he asks,
"while you were gone?"
"I was in a house with many rooms. The sea sweeps through the house. Sometimes it swept over me, but always I was saved." Askill pauses and frowns.
"That's not... you're not..." he begins.
He thinks for a moment.
"What I mean is, you've had problems. A breakdown of sorts. At least, that's what I've been told. Are you getting treatment for that?"
"My family have arranged for me to see a psychotherapist, to which I have no objection. But I have refused medication, and so far, no one has insisted."
"Well, I hope it helps," he says, kindly.
"Thank you."
"What I'm trying to get at," he says, "is whether Dr. Ketterly persuaded you to go anywhere. Whether he kept you anywhere against your will. Whether you were free to come and go."
"Yes, I was free. I came and went. I did not remain in one place. I walked for hundreds, perhaps thousands of kilometers."
Oh, okay. "And Dr. Ketterly wasn't with you when you walked?"
"No."
"Was anyone with you?"
"No, I was quite alone."
Oh, well.
Jamie Askill is slightly disappointed. I am disappointed too, in a way. Disappointed that I have disappointed him.
"Well," he says, "I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you've already spoken to D.S. Raphael."
"Yes."
"She's amazing, isn't she, Raphael?"
"Yes."
"I'm not surprised that she found you. I mean, if anyone was going to find you, it was probably always going to be her."
He pauses.
"Of course, she can be a little... I mean, she doesn't really..."
He fishes in the air with his fingers to catch at the elusive words.
"I mean, she's not necessarily the easiest person in the world to work with. And time management, definitely not her thing." but honestly, we all think the world of her. It is right to think the world of Raphael, I tell him. She is an extraordinary person. Exactly. Did anyone ever tell you about Penny Wheeler? No, I say. Who or what is Penny Wheeler? A guy in some city in the Midlands, where Raphael started out. He was an upset sort of person, a troubled person, the sort of person that ends up having a lot to do with us. That's not good. No, it's not. There was this one time something happened to set him off, and he climbed up inside the cathedral tower. He got onto a sort of gallery and was shouting abuse at the people inside the cathedral. He had some bales of old dirty newspaper that he used to take everywhere, and he started setting it on fire and throwing it down onto people. How terrible. I know. Frightening, isn't it? The police, got there, it was evening, all dim and dark, with flaming sheets of newspaper floating about and people dashing everywhere with fire extinguishers and buckets of sand. Raphael and another guy tried to get to Penny Wheeler, but when they were in the stairwell, which was a really tight, confined space, Penny threw a load more burning newspaper down and some of it wrapped itself around the other guy's face, so he had to go back. But Raphael did not go back, I say, with great certainty. No, she didn't. Technically speaking, she probably should have. But she didn't. When she came out onto the gallery, her hair was on fire. But you know, she's Raphael. I doubt she even noticed. The people down below had to shout at her to put the fire out. She sat down with Penny Wheeler, and she got him to stop throwing flaming newspaper everywhere. And she got him to come down. Pretty brave, don't you think? Braver than you think. She doesn't like heights. She doesn't. They make her uncomfortable. That wouldn't stop her, he says. No. Thank God she didn't have to do any of that with you. She didn't have to walk through fire or whatever. She just went to the seaside. That's what I heard anyway, that she found you at the seaside. Yes, I was at the side of the sea. A lot of missing people turn up at seaside places, he muses. It's the sea, I suppose. It has a soothing effect. Certainly did on me, I say. He smiles cheerfully at me. Excellent, he says. Matthew Rose Sorensen has reappeared. Entry for the 27th of November, 2018. Matthew Rose Sorensen's mother and father and sisters and friends all ask me where I have been. I tell them what I told Jamie Askill, that I was in a house with many rooms, that the sea sweeps through the house, and that sometimes it swept over me, but always I was saved. Matthew Rose Sorensen's mother and father and sisters and friends tell each other that this is a description of a mental breakdown seen from the inside. An explanation they find reasonable, perhaps even reassuring. They have Matthew Rose Sorensen back, or so they believe. A man with his face and voice and gestures moves about the world, and that is enough for them. I no longer look like Piranesi. There are no coral beads or fish bones in my hair. My hair is clean and cut and styled. I am clean-shaven. I wear the clothes that were brought to me out of the storage in which Matthew Rose Sorensen's sisters had placed them. Rose Sorensen had a great number of clothes, all meticulously cared for. He had more than a dozen suits, which I find surprising considering that his income was not large. This love of clothes was something he shared with Piranesi. Piranesi frequently wrote about Dr. Ketterly's clothes in his journal and lamented the contrast with his own ragged garments. This, I suppose, is where I differ from both of them, from Matthew Rose Sorensen and Piranesi. I find I do not care greatly about clothes. Many other things were delivered to me out of storage, the most important being Matthew Rose Sorensen's missing journals. They cover the period from June 2000, when he was an undergraduate, until December 2011. As for the rest of his possessions, I am getting rid of most of them. Piranesi cannot bear to have so many possessions. I do not need this, is his constant refrain. Piranesi is always with me, but of Rose Sorensen, I have only hints and shadows. I piece him together out of the objects he has left behind, from what is said about him by other people, and of course, from his journals. Without the journals, I would be all at sea. I remember how this world works, more or less. I remember what Manchester is, and what the police are, and how to use a smartphone. I can pay for things with money, though I still find the process strange and artificial. Piranesi has a strong dislike of money. Piranesi wants to say, but I need the thing you have, so why don't you just give it to me? And then, when I have something you need, I will just give it to you. This would be a simpler system and much better. But I, who am not Piranesi, or at least not only him, realize that this probably wouldn't go down too well. I have decided to write a book about Lawrence Arne Sales. It is something that Matthew Rose Sorensen wanted to do, and something that I want to do. After all, who knows Arne Sales' work better than me? Raphael has shown me what Lawrence Arne Sales taught her. How to find the path to the labyrinth, and how to find the path out again. I can come and go as I please. Last week, I took a train to Manchester. I took a bus to Miles Platting. I walked through a bleak autumn landscape to a flat in a tower block. The door was answered by a thin, ravaged-looking man who smelt strongly of cigarettes. "Are you James Ritter?" I asked. He agreed that he was. "I've come to take you back," I said. I led him through the shadowy corridor, and when the noble minotaurs of the first vestibule rose up around us, he started to cry. Not for fear, but for happiness. He went immediately and sat under the great marble sweep of the staircase, the place where he used to sleep. He closed his eyes and listened to the sounds of the tides. When it was time to leave, he begged me to let him stay, but I refused. "You don't know how to feed yourself," I told him. "You never learnt. You would die here unless I fed you, and I can't take on that responsibility. But I'll bring you back here whenever you want, and if ever I decide to come back for good, I promise I will bring you with me." The body of Valentine Ketterly, magician and scientist. Entry for the 28th of November, 2018. The body of Valentine Ketterly, magician and scientist, is washed by the tides. I have placed it in one of the lower halls, accessed from the 8th vestibule, and I have tethered it to the statue of a half-reclining man. The statue's eyes are closed. He is possibly asleep. Thick snakes and serpents entwine themselves heavily with his limbs. The body is contained in a sack of plastic netting. The mesh of the netting is wide enough for fish to poke their mouths in and birds their beaks. It is fine enough that none of the small bones will be lost. I estimate that in 6 months' time, the bones will be white and clean. I will gather them up and take them to the empty niche in the third northwestern hall. I will place Valentine Ketterly next to the biscuit box man. In the middle, I will place the long bones, tied together with twine. On the right, I will place the skull. On the left, I will place a box containing all the small bones. Dr. Valentine Ketterly will lie with his colleagues, with Stanley Ovenden, Maurizio Giussani, and Silvia D'Agostino. Statues again. Entry for the 29th of November, 2018. Piranesi lived among statues, silent presences that brought him comfort and enlightenment. I thought that in this new, old world, the statues would be irrelevant. I did not imagine that they would continue to help me. But I was wrong. When faced with a person or situation I do not understand, my first impulse is still to look for a statue that will enlighten me. I think of Dr. Ketterly, and an image rises up in my mind. It is the memory of a statue that stands in the 19th Northwestern Hall. It is the statue of a man kneeling on his plinth. A sword lies at his side, its blade broken in 5 pieces. Round about lie other broken pieces, the remains of a sphere. The man has used his sword to shatter the sphere because he wanted to understand it. But now he finds that he has destroyed both sphere and sword. This puzzles him, but at the same time, part of him refuses to accept that the sphere is broken and worthless. He has picked up some of the fragments and stares at them intently in the hope that they will eventually bring him new knowledge. I think of Lawrence Arne Sayles, and an image rises up in my mind. It is the memory of a statue that stands in an upper vestibule facing the head of a staircase, the one rising up out of the 32nd vestibule. This statue represents a heretical pope seated on a throne. He is fat and bloated. He lolls on his throne, a shapeless mass. The throne is magnificent, but the sheer bulk of the figure threatens to split it in two. He knows that he is repulsive, but you can see by his face that the idea pleases him. He revels in the thought that he is somehow shocking. In his face there is mingled laughter and triumph. "Look at me," he seems to say. "Look at me." I think of Raphael, and an image, no, two images, rise up in my mind. In Piranesi's mind, Raphael is represented by a statue in the 44th Western Hall. It shows a queen in a chariot, the protector of her people. She is all goodness, all gentleness, all wisdom, all motherhood. That is Piranesi's view of Raphael, because Raphael saved him. But I choose a different statue. In my mind, Raphael is better represented by a statue in an antechamber that lies between the 45th and the 62nd Northern Halls. This statue shows a figure walking forward holding a lantern. It is hard to determine with any certainty the gender of the figure. It is androgynous in appearance. From the way she or he holds up the lantern and peers at whatever is ahead, one gets the sense of a huge darkness surrounding her. Above all, I get the sense that she is alone, perhaps by choice, or perhaps because no one else was courageous enough to follow her into the darkness. Of all the billions of people in this world, Raphael is the one I know best and love most. I understand much better now, better than Piranesi ever could, the magnificent thing she did in coming to find me, the magnitude of her courage. I know that she returns to the labyrinth often. Sometimes we go together. Sometimes she goes alone. The quiet and the solitude attract her strongly. In them she hopes to find what she needs. It worries me. "Don't disappear," I tell her sternly. "Do not disappear." She makes a rueful, amused face. "I won't," she says. "We can't keep rescuing each other," I say. "It's ridiculous." She smiles. It is a smile with a little sadness in it. But she still wears the perfume, the first thing I ever knew of her. And it still makes me think of sunlight and happiness. In my mind are all the tides. Entry for the 30th of November, 2018. In my mind are all the tides, their seasons, their ebbs and their flows. In my mind are all the halls, the endless procession of them, the intricate pathways. When this world becomes too much for me, when I grow tired of the noise and the dirt and the people, I close my eyes and I name a particular vestibule to myself. Then I name a hall. I imagine I am walking the path from the vestibule to the hall. I note with precision the doors I must pass through, the rights and lefts that I must take, the statues on the walls that I must pass. Last night I dreamt that I was standing in the fifth northern hall facing the statue of the gorilla. The gorilla dismounted from his plinth and came towards me with his slow knuckle walk. He was grey-white in the moonlight, and I flung my arms around his massive neck and told him how happy I was to be home. When I awoke, I thought, I am not home. I am here. It began to snow. Entry for the 1st of December, 2018. This afternoon, I walked through the city, making for a cafe where I was to meet Raphael. It was about 2:30, on a day that had never really got light. It began to snow. The low clouds made a grey ceiling for the city. The snow muffled the noise of the cars until it became almost rhythmical, a steady, shushing noise, like the sound of tides beating endlessly on marble walls. I closed my eyes. I felt calm. There was a park. I entered it and followed a path through an avenue of tall, ancient trees with wide, dusky, grassy spaces on either side of them. The pale snow sifted down through bare winter branches. The lights of the cars on the distant road sparkled through the trees, red, yellow, white. It was very quiet. Though it was not yet twilight, the street lights shed a faint light. People were walking up and down on the path. An old man passed me. He looked sad and tired. He had broken veins on his cheeks and a bristly white beard. As he screwed up his eyes against the falling snow, I realized I knew him. He is depicted on the northern wall of the 48th Western Hall. He is shown as a king, with a little model of a walled city in one hand, while the other hand he raises in blessing. I wanted to seize hold of him and say to him, in another world you are a king, noble and good. I have seen it. But I hesitated a moment too long, and he disappeared into the crowd. A woman passed me with two children. One of the children had a wooden recorder in his hands. I knew them too. They are depicted in the 27th Southern Hall. A statue of two children laughing, one of them holding a flute. I came out of the park. The city streets rose up around me. There was a hotel with a courtyard, with metal tables and chairs for people to sit in more clement weather. Today they were snow-strewn and forlorn. A lattice of wire was strung across the courtyard. Paper lanterns were hanging from the wires, spheres of vivid orange that blew and trembled in the snow and the thin wind. The sea-grey clouds raced across the sky, and the orange lanterns shivered against them. The beauty of the house is immeasurable. Its kindness, infinite.